North Houston, Texas, we don't only sing, but we dance just as good as we want. In Houston, we just started a new dance called the Tighten Up. This is the music we tighten up with. First, tighten up on the drum. Come on now, drummer. I want you to tighten it up for me now. Oh, yeah. Tighten up on that bass now. Tighten it up. Yeah. Now let that guitar fall in. Oh, yeah. Tighten up on the organ now.
Hi, everybody. We're live.
Hi.
So I spent all day cleaning up water damage. That was really fun.
Oh, you went to the beach?
I meant to send you that Instagram thing that I saw today. I didn't do it because I thought it would be too cruel, but now you're bringing it up. I'm going to find it and send it. Go on.
So first of all, what I was saying last week about... So we're lucky that the leak at the beach house was worse than I expected, but... It only affected like the storage basement area of the house, not like the finished interior of the house. Thank God for that, because that would be a very different level of damage. and most of the things that we store in the storage area are things like bikes, which are mostly waterproof. So there doesn't look like there's too much loss there.
Plus, it's fresh water. It's actually cleaning the bicycles, getting the salt off.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't only bikes that were rained on for, you know, a day and a half, but it was mostly bikes. So it's not too bad. It could have been a lot worse. There's a lot of cleanup to do, but it could have been a lot worse. But you mentioned Instagram, and that actually gives me a really good opportunity here to tell you a little hot tip. It's not it didn't start during my year of efficiency, but it started about December, I think. I don't think I've mentioned it on the show, at least not more than 2 seconds worth. So I haven't really been on Instagram very much recently. There's been a sharp drop off in my Instagram music starting in December when I made a simple change. And I can say I strongly recommend this. So anyway, what the change was I moved Instagram to the hidden state on my phone where it requires Face ID. So here's what you do. You go to any app on your phone. They added this, I think, 2 or 3 OSs ago. Any app on iOS, if you do the long hold to go to delete it, and one of the options it gives you on is require Face ID in that context menu. And when you do that, there's one of the options you get is to hide and require Face ID. And this puts the app in... If you go all the way to the app library, like the rightmost screen on your iPhone, and you scroll all the way to the bottom right icon is called hidden. And you can't see what's in it because it's hidden. And if you hide any app and require Face ID for it, it will go into that hidden folder. The only way to get to it is to go to the app library. It won't show up in search. You won't get any notifications for it. Your phone will act as though it's not there at all. And then the only way to get to it is you go to that hidden folder, you tap it. For some reason, you have to tap it again. It Face ID scans you. Then the icon will show up and you can open the app. And you can use the app just normally. But if you leave the app for more than like a second or two, it will not show up in the app switcher. You can't switch back to it. You have to go through that process again.
Interesting.
And again, so you're not getting notifications. So it's never being promoted to you on your phone at all. So what this does is it creates a situation where you have to think about going to it. You have to want to go to it. And you have to want to go to it enough that you go through like a little bit of friction to get to it. You can't just search for it in Spotlight. You have to go and scroll to it and do the Face ID and have it open up. And if you switch away from it, so, for instance, if you're like looking at an Instagram ad and you switch out to Safari to, you know, be able to save that page for later, maybe, and maybe use Apple Pay to buy something, it's kind of a pain in the butt to switch back. Also, universal links to that app will stop working. So what it does is it makes using the app totally suck, and it makes you not want to do it very often, which for Instagram means that the compulsion that I had and that many people have to just idly open it up all the time. I had it on my home screen. I'd open it up. It's super easy. And then before I knew it, I'd wasted a bunch of time there and opened up six tabs for shirts I might want to buy. That doesn't happen anymore. It's just gone. And I have dramatically reduced the amount of time I use Instagram as a result. And I got to tell you, I am so much happier and better off for it. I don't have as many shirts, but everything else in my life is better. And I got to say, like, it really made me realize quite how bad for me Instagram really was. It doesn't feel that bad when you're using it until you realize you've, like, you know, spent a lot of time there, and maybe you're just becoming, you know, just unhappy with your life and you want to buy a bunch of stuff. And not having Instagram be a major part of my life and have it be almost not a part of my life at all, it's great. Like, I was keeping it because I thought I was going to be missing out on not only, like, you know, whatever friends are doing. I mean, most of my feed isn't that anymore. But even stuff like, you know, at the beach, like what restaurants are doing tonight for their specials, or, you know, what special events are happening around town. And the reality is most of that stuff I don't miss, first of all, because it wasn't that important, as it turns out. And second of all, what Instagram mostly is these days is a feed full of stuff to keep me engaged, not really a lot of stuff that my friends are actually posting. So my life has been made significantly better by having it still available if I have to go look at something, but almost never looking at it. So it cut it down from using it from probably maybe an average of a half hour a day down to using it for maybe 5 minutes a week at most. It's amazing. I strongly recommend doing this to social apps, because when people say that, like, they're stuck in their phone, or they're addicted to their phone, or their phone's the problem, or phones in general are the problem, what they're mostly talking about is social network apps on phones, which is different from the phone. The phone is just a computer. It's an amazing – it's the phone is, like, one of the greatest things we've ever invented as a species. The modern smartphone is this ridiculously amazing, capable pocket supercomputer connected to the internet at all times that can do amazing things for us. The phone is great. The phone is not a problem. Addictive social apps are a problem in a lot of ways. So doing steps like that to, like, increase the friction, like – the best thing is to just delete it off your phone if you can do that. But if you still need it sometimes, that's a way to keep it still there, but not have it be very addictive to you. So I can strongly recommend it.
Wait, I'm sorry. How did we leap from beach cleanup to Instagram? Did I have a brain fart?
I was sending up the Instagram thing about the burst pipes. It's in the Slack if you want to look at it. I mean, it's not ours. It's just a public thing. So I guess we can put it in the show notes if you want. Although, Marco, I'm glad this change has made a difference in your life. It sounds good. I mean, you made Quitter, the Mac app, to help you with Twitter before that. So it's a long history of you doing these things. But every time I hear you describe these systems, I just am glad I don't have that kind of adversarial relationship with myself that you do. Because you are the solution to and cause of all your problems, and you're battling against
just
yourself
like
by writing software to stop you from being you.
I've never been officially diagnosed with ADHD, mostly because I've never really sought that kind of diagnosis, because it's a little bit late as an adult for most of the ways that could be really problematic for
it's
my
never
life.
Too late to learn to read.
Yeah, but this is. I mean, look, if your brain works this way, you know it, and my brain definitely works this way, and we have to develop systems.
Luckily it works
ourselves.
The other way, which lets you devise systems to thwart yourself.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean.
You have the other side of that too, which is good.
Like the systems I have to do to maintain, like, you know, attention and task doing are ridiculous. Like, part of the reason why the snooze options on Apple Reminders alerts bother me so much, the stupid, like, remind me this afternoon and it's 2 p.m. Like, what does that mean? What time? If it's already 2 p.m. and it says remind me this afternoon, what does that mean? And when it's 9 a.m. and it says remind me this morning, what does that mean? I hate, like, I cannot tell you how asinine those reminder strings are. Like, give me a time or give me more hour intervals.
That's
anyway.
Right. The thing I do with reminders, I mean, yes, I know there's a million alternative apps that we should be using instead, right? But what I actually just use reminders, and what I do is I just go into reminders and I change the time to be advanced by the amount that I want it to be advanced. It's the most ridiculous thing ever. I'm essentially manually snoozing, because when I set the time forward, I know exactly when it's going to go off again.
Yeah, see, like, this is like, and I know I should be using Due, D-U-E. I know that.
And we know all the apps. We know.
Yeah,
we know.
I think maybe one of my, we're not talking about AI this episode, but maybe one of my Vibe Code apps will be like, just use the reminders database, but have better alerts for it. Like, there's probably already apps
that exists
do that.
In the App Store already.
I know it probably does, but like, I want the reminders to be the app, because that way Siri integration works perfectly. A lot of other system integrations work perfectly. But those notification snooze options are just so bad. And the whole reason I snooze them is because in my terrible productivity system of my brain, if I'm not being reminded of something over and over and over again until I do it, it won't get done. And
That's the DUI.
I know. I just don't like the rest of the app. And if I accidentally dismiss one of those alerts, it will never remind me again. So it's like, I have to like be so careful when one of those pops up, like, oh God, oh no, don't, careful. Snooze for 1 hour. Okay. Or remind me this afternoon, whatever that means. Remind me tonight. That's great too. It's like, what does that mean? Like, anyway, I wish those were better, and maybe someday I'll make them better. And I know the system is ridiculous, and the system sounds ridiculous that I get reminded of like four things every day recurring until I do them, and it might take me 2 weeks to do them. This sounds ridiculous to anybody who is like productive and normal-minded, and that is so not me. My system needs this.
Very quickly, I wholeheartedly endorse the app DUE, you know, do, but when I pronounce the word do, nobody knows what I mean. It's DUEapp.com. I'll put a link in the show notes. My life would, not literally, but figuratively end if this app did not exist. I would get nothing done. We have gone far longer on this pre-flight immediately after Marco and I both said we don't want to go long. What is the result of the beach situation, though? Did you get a plumber to come out? Like, where does it stand?
Yeah, a plumber came out yesterday and fixed the leak. I went out there today. Had to do basic, you know, just clean up, you know, because there's a lot of things in the basement that are very wet and waterlogged, a lot of like, you know, storage containers that are full of water, plus whatever they were storing. Those light fixtures on the ceiling of like nautical themed basement areas that have, it's like a metal cage around a glass dome, but it's all sealed up. Well, there were, you know, we have those all across our basement ceiling, and the ones that the water was above were full of water, like the dome. So I had to like, you know, get a drill, unscrew the dome, and water just poured down. Like, obviously those light bulbs are dead. Those fixtures I will probably be replacing. So a lot of that. But and with the added complexity that it was about 30 degrees, and so it's very, very cold out there. And, you know, all like as I was like carrying water-filled containers out to dump them on, like, you know, the patio, I have to make sure I'm not dumping them where I have to walk, because it's all freezing a few minutes later. So the patio is covered in ice. Like, it's right. And of course, you know, whatever gloves I'm wearing are instantly soaked with everything I'm doing. So I had to keep, like, taking breaks, going upstairs, just warming up for a few minutes, then going back out again. Like, it was a hard day, but at least I didn't have Instagram bothering me.
Well, that's true.
I did have a couple of reminders, though. Did I do the things? No.
I actually have a couple or a related story, as I also told John and Marco that I did not want to go long tonight, but here we go. I was sitting in the living room yesterday, maybe it was the day before, and I know it must have been yesterday, and that's where our Yolink hub is.
Yolink.
So, you know, the Yolink stuff that we have some leak sensors, we have some contact sensors, which we will probably talk about in the after show tonight. Anyways, the speaker hub sits in the living room in the entertainment center, which is an open entertainment center. And I have, of course, done a bunch of stuff with Home Assistant such that, for example, when the mailbox is opened out front, the speaker hub will literally say the words, "You've got mail," because I'm a child of the 90s.
Does it have the old sound effect?
No, unfortunately.
Why not?
It's more robotic. It's more like, "You've got mail," whatever.
You got to get the sound effect from that awesome announcer. He just died like last year. But
yeah, I don't think I can actually use a sound effect, but that's neither here nor there. But I'm sitting there and I'm, you know, watching TV or browsing something on the internet, and all of a sudden I hear a siren going off.
Uh-oh.
And that indicates to me, because the only reason that should happen is based on automations I've done in Home Assistant, the only reason that should happen if a water leak sensor has tripped. And so sure enough, the siren goes off and it says there's a leak in Casey's sink. And I go bombing upstairs, and I tell you what, there was a little itty bitty puddle of water under there. It must be like a little teeny tiny drip, but over the span of like a day or something, it was enough to trip the leak sensor, because the way it works is there's a couple of electrodes or whatever on the bottom and a couple on the top. And so sure enough, the water was able to basically create a connection between the two on the bottom, and it alerted me. And so we were able to clean it up lickety split, where, you know, we got on the horn with our bathroom people and they're going to come out first thing next week, because it's not a pressing issue. You know, it's a very, 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 very minor leak. But I would never in a million years have noticed this were it not for those leak sensors. So not sponsored by Yolink, but sponsored by Yolink.
Yeah, those things, what's great about them, again, as I mentioned last time, what's great about them is that the sensors are cheap and there's no like subscription per sensor or anything. So you can get, I think the 4-pack is like $60 with the hub or something. So it's, and you can just get, you can get as many as you need. So, you know, in my house, I have, I think like 10 of them or something. I have a lot of them. Right. Basically, so I have them under each bathroom sink trap, because that's usually where water tends to collect if there's a small leak, and under each toilet of the valve that fills the toilet that goes against the wall, whatever that valve is called, like where it comes out of the wall and you have little snaking up pipe thing to fill the toilet. Those tend to drip over time too. And sure enough, there was one day, the top of the Yolink water leak sensors, they have sensors on the top and the bottom. They have these little metal feet that poke down. So if they are sitting in water, they'll alert. But also they have these two little sensors up top, and they're shaped like a little bowl up top. So that way you can place it under something, and if something drips, it'll fall into that top bowl and alert you immediately before water pools up on the floor. So you can, it's good to place them under things that are most likely to be a problem, like valves and traps and things like that. And sure enough, like last summer, we were at the beach and we got a leak alert from one of the toilet valve ones, and we had somebody go over and look at it. And sure enough, that toilet valve had like a little like drip every few minutes kind of leak. And that's the kind of thing, like, you would never, especially if it's like under a sink in a cabinet. You would never know that until you open that cabinet like 2 years later and the whole bottom of it falls out. You're like, whoa. And then you see all this water damage. Like, that's the advantage of these things, is that they're so small and cheap and low maintenance. You can buy a ton of them and put them all over. I have one like obviously next to the water heater. I have one under the washing machine. Like, they're anywhere that you might have a leak. And let me tell you, now that I have dealt with the aftermath of what was, again, like, because it wasn't in the finished area of the house, this leak could have been so much worse. Thank God it was not in the finished area. Mm-hmm. But even just dealing with a storage area leak, which is not that destructive, I am not only incredibly happy that I had these sensors, but I'm adding more. And I'm definitely getting the water main automatic shutoff thing.
Yeah.
And also, when I left the house today, I just turned the water main off.
Did you empty the water lines as best you could as well? Because people will ask you.
Just like the down. I wasn't sure. So I turned the water. I was in kind of a rush. I turned the water main off, and I went up to the upstairs. I went up to the first level sinks, and I just opened the cold water until it stopped running. But I also, I'm like, am I going to burn out my hot water tank by doing this? Because if the hot water tank, so I didn't open the hot water, but if the hot water tank loses water and it's still on, then the top heating element can burn itself out. And I decided, so what I did, I also just turned off the input and output valve to the hot water tank, so it kind of just locked the water in it, whatever was already there. And also the hot water tank being replaced next week, so I figured that probably doesn't matter, because it was pretty badly damaged and it was already near the end of its life. But I figured I'd ask the plumber that when he replaces it next week. I'm like, hey, by the way, did I burn it out, or, you know, did I do the right thing here? But anyway, and we've already heard from a few people who are responding, saying that either Yolink, or there's a Moen automatic main turnoff thing that a few listeners have written in to say, like, these things basically have saved people's bacon a lot already. And so we can strongly recommend having some kind of like water leak sensing ability, and definitely look into the automatic main shutoff things too.
Yeah. All right. Before we do follow up, John, you had an announcement you'd like to make.
Yeah. Obviously, live listeners know this, but we are recording this episode early due to school vacation reasons. So if something dramatic happens before you're listening to this episode, but after we record it, like, why aren't they talking about the new M5 Max MacBook Pros? It's because at the time of recording, they didn't exist. So hopefully nothing will happen and this episode will be fine. But because it's like there, you know, so many things are imminent and coming soon from Apple in this spring period of time we find ourselves in, we don't know when it's going to happen. If it so happens that Apple releases something while we're, after we record this, but before we record the next episode, that's why. We apologize. We'll get them next time.
Yep. All right. Last after show, we talked about me looking at cars because I'm getting the 7-year itch. And we talked about a whole bunch of options. And I actually intended to, this happens to me so often, I need to take better notes, but I intended to bring up another option that I completely forgot about and one that I knew would pique John's interest. And a couple of people wrote in about this. John, you probably said something to me. I don't remember what was the first thing that happened, or maybe I just remembered, but one or the other, one way or the other, I should have brought up the Lucid Air, because the Lucid Air is like $150,000 or something like that, brand new, but they're astonishingly affordable right now if you go used. And there's one in Richmond that I kind of sort of have my eye on that's something around $45,000-$50,000, so cheaper than the Taycans I was looking at. The Lucid Air is very big, and John has done a little bit of research, which I will let you talk about in just a moment. But I really like the idea of the Lucid Air. It seems to be doing everything the way I would want to do it in terms of like CarPlay, and a lot of the switchgear looks like it's made smartly, and they do a lot. I can't think of particular examples, but it just seems like my kind of car. All that said, after my BMW experience, you know, with that car being a disaster and being a little reluctant about going back to, you know, German super performance car, I can't imagine going to like a boutique, very young car company with, I don't believe, any particular local presence would be a good choice.
Yeah, like, but what happened? Like, do you have a local service center?
Do you trust the
brand to be around in 7 years? Like, that's
right, exactly.
That's, yep. Those are big questions. And with Lucid, like, I mean, obviously, you know, I bought the first Rivian SUV, but that, first of all, that wasn't even the first Rivian vehicle. And second of all, that was with Rivian already having their deal with Amazon, with all their fleet vehicles and everything, and they were building out service centers. And I still had problems with that vehicle being like a version one of its model line and still a relatively young company with too little service infrastructure. But I was like operating with an order of magnitude better service infrastructure than what you'd be operating at with Lucid, probably.
Yeah, and I just looked it up. The nearest place for Lucid is exactly where you would expect it to be. It is in Tyson's Corner, which is the mega shopping conglomerate where the original Apple store opened. So a couple hours north of here. A
couple hours. Anyway, yeah, that's. Yeah. I think if you're looking for a vehicle that is unlikely to generate very expensive or very big pain in the butt service issues for you down the road, I would not go for Lucid.
Yeah,
and I don't know anything about their like service record. It isn't about that. It's just about the size of the company and the size of their infrastructure and the likelihood they'll still be here in 7 years. Yeah. I don't think is amazing.
Yeah, but John, you had done a little bit of research, despite what the song says, about the differences between the Air and the Taycan. Would you?
Yeah,
like
I didn't bring
to
it up just because it seemed like you were looking for a sporty car, and I wouldn't call the Lucid Air a sporty car. It's more of just like a big, nice sedan.
Well, yes, but it is astonishingly, absurdly, physics-bendingly fast, which would make
like
me happy.
Like any EV, but you're not going to get the Sapphire one for $45,000. So anyway, the Air is actually only about a half an inch longer than the Taycan, but it's 1 inch narrower. And for that amount of space, you just get so much more space in the actual car. So cargo room is 32 cubic feet versus 16 in the Taycan. So it's double the storage space. And the rear seat, I could not find good numbers on it. But having sat in both rear seats, I can tell you the rear seat of the Air is much, 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 much larger than the rear seat of the Taycan. But yeah, like, you know, if the nearest service center is multiple hours away, it's probably not the car for you.
No, I agree.
Because unlike, for example, if you got like, well, who cares? You don't need the service center. You can just take it anywhere. That's true if you get a used BMW. You can just find a local garage. But for a very rare EV, you can't just assume you can take it to the local garage and they'll know what the heck they're doing.
Yep. I couldn't agree more. But yeah, I don't know. I might go test drive it just for funsies. But
oh, you totally should.
But I don't think I would ever in a million years buy it. And follow up with regard to the Taycan specifically, I still am 95% convinced that it is not the car for me. However, the salesperson, the dealer, emailed me earlier today and was like, hey, what are you thinking? And I was like, well, you know, I was really disappointed with the transmission, but that might be a me problem, you know, and I'm still worried about the garage, which I'd spoken to her about when I was with her. You know, is there any chance you could give it to me for like a couple hours or overnight or something like that? And she came back almost immediately and said, absolutely, tell me when. And so I think what I'm going to do is sometime next week. I'm not sure specifically when. It might not be before we air or before we record next week. But at some point next week, I plan to steal the car for a few hours, give it a proper run through, and see if I can convince myself that the transmission is livable. Even if I can.
Why, though?
I just want to know. I just want to know. Because,
but like, why are you trying so hard to make a car work that's not working?
Get a fair assessment of it. If he was just upsetting that he changed that made the car unappealing and something he turns it on and it's appealing, you know. It doesn't mean he's going to get it. It's just
true.
It's just a fun thing to do. It's like it's the same reason I'm telling to test drive cars that he's never going to buy. It's just a fun thing to do.
Yeah. All right, moving along. Marco's move to Chrome. Sarvaganan writes, check out the Helium browser, which is Chromium, but with all the Google stuff stripped out. It also has the bang syntax built in. That's the, you know, like exclamation mark A for Amazon, for example, that we talked about a couple of weeks ago. If you just want the bang shortcut syntax, you can use the unduck.link website, and that's also a super fast option. The only thing with this, like, this is a very good recommendation if you wanted Google out of your life, but I thought you kind of wanted Google in your life, given that you're using like Gemini and whatnot.
Yeah, so there's a reason why I don't really want that kind of option. Number one is, yes, I basically do just want Google in my life right now, because again, this is more, we're not talking about AI this episode. We're doing great so far, but we've gotten a lot of feedback of like, here's another Chrome-based or Chromium-based browser. Why don't you use this instead? And my overall reason, I have used Chromium-based browsers over the years. I used Brave for a while, never as my primary, but always like, I always wanted to keep a Chrome-based browser around for compatibility stuff and, you know, sites that required it. And I always found those browsers to be not only more of a pain in the butt, but overall, not a better experience than using Chrome. You know, it was more of a sidestep. Like, some things would be better, some things would be worse. And I've never really been that impressed by them. And in this case, with my giving in to Google, I'm both seeking, you know, Google's direct services, obviously, as I was saying with Gemini, but also I want there to be as few like pain in the butt problems as possible. I don't want a single incompatibility. I don't want a single piece of additional friction. And every time I used a non-Chrome, Chrome-based browser, I would have occasional little bits of additional friction. Something wouldn't work right, or something would bother me, or something would, you know, need to be updated in some weird way. Like, and regular Chrome just has never done that for me. This isn't the first time I've used regular Chrome. Like, I usually have it installed for many years. So I kind of know what I'm in for with Chrome. And so I actually don't see all those alternative browsers as being a better fit for me.
It's the year of BASIC, and Helium is not BASIC.
I don't know.
Wow. All right. With regard to Windows resizing in Tahoe, what's the recap on this, John? This is the thing where the edges are super rounded and you can't actually resize by the edges.
Yeah, like they made the corners of the windows much more rounded in Tahoe, but they didn't move the area of the imaginary rectangular window that you click on to resize it. And so the clickable resize area is increasingly incongruous with the actual outline of the window in Tahoe. And there was a whole bunch of complaints about that.
Righto. So Jeff Johnson noted that in the macOS Tahoe 26.3 RC release notes, there's a section app kit, a section resolved issues, in which it says window resize area now areas now follow corner radius instead of using square regions. Then later in the 26.3 release, Norbert Hager, who is the co-founder of Objective Development and developer of LaunchBar and Little Snitch, notes the release notes have been updated. The problem went from a, quote, resolved issue, quote, to a, quote, known issue, quote. And there's a little bit of discussion about that, including a very trick sample app that Norbert wrote that you should see like a little GIF
of. So basically in the RC, they're like, we fixed it. And then in the release, they're like, just kidding. It's back to exactly how it was before. So I don't know if the fix, I mean, I was all ready to say in this section, you know, I had this whole big spiel about I can kind of understand why they didn't change the resize region, because moving that region could potentially mess with content in people's windows and potentially break apps by making certain things in the window unclickable because they used to not be under the resize area, but now they are because Apple moved it. And so I could understand why they wouldn't want to do that. But then in the RC, it's like, well, they moved it, so I guess that wasn't a compatibility problem. And then in the release, they undid that change, so maybe it was a compatibility problem. Who knows? But yeah, the app that Norbert made is really cool. Like, it basically just moves the cursor across the things in like an automated way and maps out a pixel at a time exactly where the resized regions are and then visualizes them. So please do follow this link in the show notes. Norbert was the person who first posted about this, by the way. I didn't have all his info on him at the time. So anyways, a well-known developer, but just not known to me. But very cool work, very cool app, and very cool visualization of the problem in Tahoe.
AirTags 2, there's been a lot of conversation about whether or not it's easier to tamper with them, particularly removing the speaker, which I guess dirtbags want to do in order to track people and not have them alerted. iFixit did a teardown and a video about it. It's very short. We'll put a link in the show notes. And they found basically no improvement. It was still pretty trivial to disable the speaker if you have physical access to the AirTag. Sad trombone.
Yeah. Again, I'm not sure there's anything you can really do in that scenario unless you like seal the thing and encase it in carbonite or whatever, or you can't actually get any of the parts, like seal it into I don't know. I guess if the battery, you can get at the battery and then the rest of it could be encased in acrylic or something. I mean, I can imagine solutions, but it's tricky. But anyway, it's not tricky at all with these things. You just open it up and snip the wires to the speaker and you're done.
Yeah. With regard to your journey with Cloudflare and restricting access to stuff, you were talking, I think, about your vibe coded. We're still not talking about AI. Your vibe coded.
Batting 1,000. You two are doing terribly.
Your vibe coded status board. And we actually had George Black write in and say, I work on the access team here at Cloudflare. While access falls under our zero trust umbrella of enterprise products, it actually works great as a standalone service for securing personal web apps. This is how a lot of people use the service. I think you'll find it surprisingly easy to set up. It takes just a few clicks in the dashboard. No need to install or configure anything on your machine. I made a quick video tutorial for John in case he's interested. This was like a 10-minute video, which I watched and was riveted by. George did a great job explaining it. And if you're interested in this sort of thing, it's very much worth your time.
Yeah, very cool. Still isn't really what I'm looking for, but it's good to know that it's there. And setting it up is very easy and does not actually require you to get like an OpenID Connect server or do any weird VPN stuff or whatever. It's basically just clicking around. Like so many things, it's basically like clicking around on the Cloudflare dashboard a little bit to get things set up, and then you're off to the races. So check out the video. Even though the video is like personally directly addressing me by name, which is weird, check it out. Just pretend your name is John.
Oh, man, that's great. So in other news, you moved to Fastmail, which I believe we talked about, right?
We did.
Okay, right. Okay, good. And Fastmail just tweeted recently, posted on Mastodon, why don't you hear about Perl in the headlines? Because it works and keeps working. Sometimes the best technology is the most boring. And this is relevant because Fastmail has donated 10,000 American dollar dues to the Perl in Raku Foundation. Raku? What the hell is that?
I would say Raku.
Okay. What is that?
Sounds like a Star Wars planet.
The artist formerly known as Perl 6.
They renamed the entire freaking version to a new name?
It's a long, sad story.
What's the short?
The short is Perl 6 was taking a really long time, and it was because it had the name Perl and the number one bigger than Perl 5, it was kind of like stealing all of Perl 5's thunder, and Perl 5 wanted to go ahead, but it felt like it couldn't go anywhere because who's going to pay attention to Perl 5 when Perl 6 exists? And they solved the problem by saying, guess what? Perl 6 is now, they just switched to like their code name, right? It's like when you get a pet with like a name you think you're going to change and you don't change it. Anyway, so now Perl 5 was free to go forward with the Perl name and advance itself without everybody saying, why are you working on that? Isn't it dead? Perl 6 is going to replace it. Now when it's called Perl and Raku, no one thinks that anymore. Not that it's really particularly relevant. That's the best summary I can give. It's way more complicated and drama-filled than that, as these things always are. But anyway, the foundation supports both of them, so that's why it's not just the Perl Foundation, it's the Perl and Raku Foundation.
So what are you using for your projects?
Just plain old Perl, Perl 5, which has continued to advance and does lots of things. And yeah, whenever I see someone writing Perl code and I look at it and I'm like, that Perl code has been frozen in amber since the 90s. Perl has actually advanced as a language and has new features, and Raku also exists, which is mostly being ignored by almost everybody, including me. But Pearl5 is still out there, and I'm glad seeing Fastmail donate to it. And why would they be donating to it?
Well, hold on. I'm not done interrogating you yet. Is there anything that Raku, whatever it's called, brings to the table that you're enthusiastic about?
Oh, yeah. No, it's got lots of really cool features as a language. I mean, I used to talk about it a lot on the show. When Swift was being developed, I talked about it a lot because Swift actually takes a lot of ideas from both Pearl 5 and Pearl 6 and what was formerly known as Pearl 6. Raku's got tons of great ideas. The problem is it doesn't really have like a solid implementation and community and everything, like all the other sort of ecosystem things surrounding it. And part of the promise of Pearl 6 to me has always been in my mind that due to all the advancements in the language, it should also have higher performance and lower memory overhead and all these great things. And that has not materialized either. So it's mostly just it's not a curiosity, but it's like it is a lesser used language with lots of very interesting features without like a bulletproof production implementation that tons of people are banging on all the time. So I'm not sure what the future holds for Raku. Very interesting language from a language design perspective. Lots of ideas that every other language should steal, but I don't feel like it has the community or the time and implementation of even Pearl 5, let alone all the other more modern languages, to show that it is production ready and substantially better than its predecessor when it comes down to just running all the time on a server or whatever.
Fair enough. Well, I appreciate it. Remember, we're not running long tonight. Anyway, Fastmail donated 10 grand to the Pearl and Raku Foundation, reading from the Pearl.com post about it. Pearl has served us quite well since... Oh, I'm sorry. Let me back up a half step. This is from the Pearl.com post, but this is a quote from Ricardo Signes, who is the director and chief developer experience officer at Fastmail.
Also, so, former Pump King of Pearl programming language. If you don't know what that is, you can look it up. But this is
it's a beer.
The Pearl connections run deep at Fastmail is what I'm saying.
Okay. So Ricardo says, Pearl has served us quite well since Fastmail's inception. We've built up a large code base that has continued to work, grow, and improve over 20 years. We've stuck with Pearl because Pearl stuck with us. It kept working and growing and improving, and very rarely did those improvements require us to stop the world and adapt to onerous changes. We know that kind of stability is, in part, a function of the developers of Pearl, whose time is spent figuring out how to make Pearl better without also making it worse. The money we give towards these efforts is well spent because it keeps the improvements coming and the language reliable.
Yeah, there's a very strong sort of backwards compatibility culture in Pearl to a fault, where like I remember there was just this huge debate years ago over removing EBCDIC support, which I'm pronouncing in a weird way. You know what I'm talking about, though, like the thing that's not ASCII for encoding letters as a bunch of numbers. EBCDIC, something like that. Anyway,
Okay. They
were like, can we remove that from the language? Is anybody still using it? It's like, what century or where are we? What's going on? That's the kind of dedication that had to backward compatibility. And then, of course, Pearl 6 overshadowing it was just making it so it was difficult to advance. Now with that out of the way, slowly, steadily, carefully, always with very careful backward compatibility, Pearl 5 has been advancing. And that's great for a production system because new versions of the language will fix bugs and have better performance and add new features, but not break your existing application.
Yeah. Also, if you were interested in throwing John a little affiliate revenue, and if you're interested in Fastmail, which you should be, I don't recall if they've ever sponsored the show, but certainly they get our okie dokie. Where is your referral link, John?
It's hypercritical.co/fastmail. Link will be in the show notes.
Indeed. We have yet another sob story, horror story about doing purchase migration with your Apple account. Nick writes that I purchased Final Cut Pro for $500 Australian and Logic Pro for $300 on a secondary Apple ID. I chose to migrate the purchases to my primary Apple ID because I was sick of having to sign in and out of the App Store to update the software. Since Apple made it possible to migrate purchases, I thought this was a perfect opportunity. Oh, how wrong I was. Turns out, migrating purchases simply allows the new account to access these purchases, but the licenses remain with the previous account. So when I deleted the old account, the purchases went with it. Apple told me that because the purchases were linked to the old account that was deleted, there was nothing they could do. Apparently, migration isn't migration at all. Seems like a useless feature to me, yet still totally an Apple thing to do. Can confirm. Yes, I am aware now that it does say that if the secondary account is deleted, the purchases go with it in the Apple knowledge base. We'll put that link in the show notes. But I was unaware of that at the time, or probably forgot as I deleted the secondary account about a month later. Though this still doesn't negate the fact that migration implies a migration and not simply sharing the purchases, maybe they should call it purchase sharing instead.
I had no idea this existed either, and I would never assume that it did. And I feel bad, like just... Boy, how many ways can they mess up these features? Like, a lot of the other stories, like, oh, I tried to do it and there was weird bugs and nobody could figure it out. But this is not a bug. This is how the feature works. And I don't think anyone would ever guess if you describe the purchase migration feature at a high level or just hear the name that it doesn't actually migrate the purchases. It just lets you use them. And if you ever delete the old Apple ID, which of course you want to do, like the whole point of purchase migration is like, let me consolidate my life and get rid of that old stuff. And now I'll just delete that so I don't have to worry about it. Nope, that will take away all your purchases. And as usual for with stories where someone doesn't have a mechanism to quote unquote run to the press, Apple just can't help at all. There was more to the story, which is like, well, no, we can't help you with your whatever it was, $800 worth of software you bought from us. You're just SOL, sorry. But hey, you want to get a free accessory from the Apple Store, which was the same thing they said to me. It's probably their big go-to. And Nick was like, sure, I'll take this. And they're like, no, that's too expensive. Now you get nothing.
Great.
It's just terrible customer service, terrible feature. Be really careful. There's a reason whenever these things come up, I'm always so cynical about it. I'm like, yeah, Apple says they have this feature, but anything having to do with Apple IDs or warranties or whatever, be cautious, because historically speaking, these features have not been implemented well. And because they're a big corporation, there's often very little recourse to get things resolved.
Yep, that's very true. And then that's it for follow-up. Good deal. All right. We have some semi-breaking news. I think it was either earlier today or perhaps yesterday that YouTube is now available as a native app on the Apple Vision Pro. You get a pretty much full YouTube client. In addition, you can use in a different tab, you can get spatial videos as well as 3D, VR 180 and 360 videos. This is genuinely very exciting. It was an extreme omission to not have YouTube or Netflix on the platform when it launched and hadn't been until a day or two ago. I haven't had the chance to plug in my Vision Pro in the last couple of days. I did want to try this before recording, but I was running around like a crazy person today. But my understanding is it's mostly pretty good. I think the only major complaint that I've heard, I think I'd seen on Andrew Edwards, like Instagram or something like that, that you can't download videos, which is kind of a bummer. But other than that, I guess it's pretty good. John, have you had a chance to try this yet?
Yeah, I tried it out. It seems fine. It's basically like what you would expect, a very minimal official YouTube client. I never tried Juno, the one from
that was very good.
Christian Selig that got booted off the App Store because Google was like, no, only we can make a YouTube app. Sorry. I'm glad they eventually did. But, you know, the app seems very basic and bare bones. I did go to the spatial tab, and the content there is not suitable for Vision Pro. It's very low resolution, blurry. I don't know if any of it is actually even stereoscopic. It is not impressive. So don't expect you're going to get the YouTube app and like, finally, this world, because they're all labeled with their thumbnails that say 16K, 360, whatever, and it's just a gigantic blurry mess. You know, it's anyway, that's not the fault of the client. This just all I'm saying is that Vision Pro content is not really available in any capacity that I could find on YouTube. So you're still stuck going back to the TV app, Apple's own TV app, and looking at the very limited selection of stuff they have there. And my question about this, like, why now? I'm wondering if this is part of the whole deal between Apple and Google to license the Gemini stuff, or is it just a happy coincidence that they finally relented and released a bare-bones YouTube client for Vision Pro? Who knows? Nobody's saying, but I'm glad it exists because it was silly that it didn't before.
You know what would be wild? I do not think this is the case, but it would be wild if, like, maybe the terms of the Gemini deal were, well, you have to put YouTube on the Vision Pro, and they're like, no, we don't want to bother with it. And then Apple says, well, what if we wrote the app? Because isn't that what they did for Google Maps?
Yeah, they used to do that for all the things, like Apple provided.
Oh, and YouTube, actually.
Google provided the map tiles, but then Apple wrote the app, and the original YouTube app on the iPhone was an Apple app as well.
Yeah, we're saying the same thing. So can you imagine if they were like, fine, we'll do it, just let us do it.
I think Apple would have done a little bit of a better job. Not that it's a bad app, it just seems very kind of, it's very basic. There's not much to it. And the little player overlay thing that goes in the bottom of the window did not look Apple-y to me. Like, I felt like the distribution of white space was unharmonious in a way that I detected. Who knows? It just didn't seem Apple-y to me. So I think Google did this one, but who knows?
Yeah. Again, I wasn't actually pitching that as a theory. I just think it's funny. The Apple Studio Display 2 is rumored to have a 90 kilohertz refresh rate instead of 120hertz. Or I just said kilohertz. A 90 hertz refresh rate instead of 120 hertz. My bad. The reading from Mac Rumors: in November 2024, an anonymous listener of the Relay FM Tech podcast Upgrade claimed that Apple was developing a 90 hertz display technology that could be used for the next studio display, as well as future iPad Air and iMac models. Now, a Mac Rumors tipster has backed up that claim based on alleged information from an internal build of iOS 26 that was leaked online. Indeed, they believe the next studio display is likely to max out at 90 hertz rather than 120 hertz. The tipster believes that a 90 hertz refresh rate would make sense due to bandwidth considerations. Thunderbolt 5 can support 5K resolution at 120 hertz without any compression, but they think Apple likely wants to ensure that there will be plenty of remaining bandwidth for connecting other devices and peripherals to the new studio display. The rumor still warrants some skepticism. The internal iOS 26 build the tipster cited is from early 2025, so Apple's plans may have changed since then.
Not sure I agree with this tipster's logic here. Like, yeah, you can reduce bandwidth by lowering the refresh rate, but if you only have one monitor connected, just run it. Use all the bandwidth. Like, you're the only monitor connected. I want 120 hertz. I really hope this is not true, because, like, how many years have we waited for Apple to finally break the 60 hertz barrier on its desktop displays? It's just, 120 is not, like, it's not rocket science. It's been on all their dinky little phones. It's on the Macs, the iPads. It's table stakes. Like, what are they doing? Like, is there some kind of differentiation? I'm like, okay, well, the studio display is for $1,600 can only go to 90 hertz. But if you want 120 hertz, you have to buy the Pro Display XDR 2 for $7,000.
Don't give them ideas. Give them ideas, please.
You can get a, as we discussed, you can get like a PC gaming display that does like 400 hertz for, you know, $800, like half the price of these things. It's ridiculous. So I really hope this is not true. Not because 90 hertz is so bad, but it's like, 120 hertz is better. Macs already have 120 hertz display, the laptops, the good laptops. For the desktops, which we know are just never updated, to not get 120 hertz, like, okay, well, I guess I'll go back to sleep for another 8 years and wait for them to finally get to 120 hertz. It's ridiculous. Please let this not be true.
I was chit-chatting with Underscore. We did our monthly FaceTime earlier this week, and he was talking about his XDR and pointed out to me that thing is like 8 years old or something like that. I forget exactly what we concluded, but
six,
it is astonishingly old, given the fact that it seems to me like it was, oh, that's what it was. We realized that we had seen the launch at WWDC 2019 because we had gone across the street from the McHenry or whatever it was to that like concert venue or whatever. I forget exactly what it was called, but then they had like the pro display like walkthrough museum sort of a situation where they showed you like the Mac Pro doing a billion different instruments, and like they had the Toy Story 4 like carnival area being rendered on a Mac Pro against a Pro Display XDR and stuff like that. So yeah, it's 2019 if I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
Bananas. All right. There's another rumor from Mac Rumors. This is Hartley Charlton at Mac Rumors writes, Apple is expected to use TSMC's base 2-nanometer N2 process rather than the newer N2P variant for its upcoming A20 and M6 chips, according to the China Times. TSMC previously said that its base N2 process would enter mass production in 2026, followed by enhanced variants, including N2P and A16, in the second half of the year.
Let's pause here for a second and just really applaud for the just massive namespace pollution and confusion.
Gosh, yes.
TSMC naming its next process A16. Oh, man. Won't be confusing at all.
Not good.
Especially since what are the Intel ones called? Don't they have names with A in them? So
I don't remember.
No, theirs are called like 18A.
Oh yeah,
they have 18A, but this is A16, which is going to be used to make the A21 processor, but it follows N2P. guys, let's get together on this, please.
They should name Sony headphones.
Right?
Well, these are short, but that's the problem. Everyone wants to call their thing A and then a very short number, but like coordinate, please.
Continuing from Hartley. N2P is positioned as a higher performance version of N2, while A16 is designed for high power and high complexity chips, particularly for AI applications, darn it, and data centers.
On a roll.
The performance difference between N2 and N2P is expected to be modest. N2P offers roughly a 5% performance gain at the same power level, but comes at a higher manufacturing cost, which helps explain why Apple is expected to remain on N2 for its A and M series chips this year.
It's a little bit weird because the whole deal with Apple's last several rounds is that Apple would pay through the nose for the very most expensive process that no one else wanted to pay for, simply because they had to have the very best of the best for their phones. I forget the last time they did that. It was like the three nanometer one where they,
yeah,
I have already forgotten the names. It was like the original N3B or something. I forgot.
N3, N3B, N3P.
Yeah, but Apple paid for the one that nobody else wanted to use because the yields were just not good, so it was so expensive. But it's like, look, if you want to have these 3-nanometer chips ready for your phones, you know, you've designed them around the idea these are going to come, you're just going to have to pay through the nose. And they bought up like all the capacity of that. And as soon as Apple was done with that, they just never used that process. Well, actually, I think they did for some of the later M series. But the point is, it was expensive and Apple paid for it. And now this is a more frugal Apple saying, do we need the most expensive, fanciest one, or can we just go with the cheaper one? It also may be because they have to make literally millions and millions of iPhones, and they can't make millions and millions of them on N2P, so they have to go with the cheaper one. But it's either unfortunate timing or Apple being wisely frugal, because honestly, I'm sure it'll be fine either way. Like, it'll be a jump from the 3-nanometer node either way, and it'll leave the door open for them to use the better N2 and A whatever processes for their later chips.
And as we noted briefly at the beginning of the show, or really 30 minutes into our pre-show, thereabouts, we're going short today, y'all, I promise. There is no M5 Pro, MacBook Pro, no M5 Pro at all.
No, you're misreading the title. You might want to reboot that. I can describe it to you again if you want.
All right, well, what did I get wrong?
It's not about the fact that the MacBook Pros haven't been released yet. It's this rumor is, you'll see when you get into the body of the thing, but the rumor is that
the transition is
basically a transitioning from talking about chips to talking about this particular chip. So I would say reboot.
Okay, all right, we're going to try that all over again.
All right,
so we mentioned at the beginning of our 30-minute, but don't worry, it's a short day today, pre-show, that we weren't going to be, or that we didn't know of any M5 MacBook Pros or anything like that. And we wanted to focus specifically on some interesting rumors with regard to the M5 Pro, the chip, that there may not be an M5 Pro chip at all. So reading from Julie Clover at Mac Rumors, the iOS 26.3 release candidate includes references to a pair of unreleased chips that are in the M5 family, according to information found by Nicholas Alvarez. Chip 1 in the beta is T6051, T6051, H17C, which we believe to be the M5 Max. Chip 2 in the beta is 6052, H17D, which is assumed to be the M5 Ultra, but not mentioned in the beta is the T6050, H17S, or M5 Pro. It's not clear why we're only seeing signs of an M5 Max and M5 Ultra chip, but rumors suggest that the new MacBook Pro models with higher-end M5 chips are set to launch in the next few weeks. Now, Ben Lovejoy at 9to5 Mac writes, a new report suggests that the M5 Pro and M5 Max might not be two distinct chips, but rather variants of the same one. So, with that in mind, 9to5 Mac, back in December of 2024, not this past December, but the one prior, writes, the M5 Pro, Max, and Ultra will use a 2.5D packaging called SOICMH, or molding horizontal, to improve production yields and thermal performance, featuring separate CPU and GPU designs. Then finally, Vadim Yuryev, who is the host of the MaxTech YouTube channel, tweeted, just figured out why Apple's M5 Pro chip did not show up in the recent beta code leak. Apple is using the new 2.5D chip tech, allowing them to use a single M5 Max chip design for both the M5 Pro and M5 Max models. This saves Apple lots of money on SKUs and design.
I don't know if Vadim has any inside info or if he's just spinning fantastical ideas, but I thought this was very interesting. First, to go rewind to the chip code names, we talked about this on a past episode, but like these numbers have been very consistent. The H and the 17 and then the letters at the end. I think that this Mac Rumor story has the list of code names, and we linked to it at one point as well. But if you go back through time, I figure what the offset is, but like the H17 is the M5, H16 is the M4, H15 is the M3, like all the way back. And then the letter suffixes have mostly been consistent. The Cs are the Maxes, the Ds are the Ultra, but also I think that the Ultra can sometimes be a G. The S has always been the Pro. You know, as they say in stocks or whatever, past performance is not necessarily an indication of future things. Apple can change the code names at any time. But whether or not there's going to be an M5 Pro, there were only two chips listed here. And there should be three, because we expect there to be a Max, a Pro, and an Ultra. And only seeing two chips and having the two existing ones look like they, for all the world, that they are the Max and the Ultra code names, where's the Pro? We talked about like the 2.5D chip stacking thing and separating the CPU and GPU and the potential to like, you know, finally divorce the CPU power from the GPU power to sort of mix and match in a way that hadn't been possible before. I still don't think that's likely, just because Apple doesn't want to have a million variants. They're not gonna build to order your CPU. They're just gonna make a few variants that they think are appropriate for their machines. But maybe it means they're having second thoughts about the Pro chip where it lies in their product line. And historically, again, I wish I'd written down the details of this, but the Pro chip has been weird in many generations, where sometimes it's basically like a Max with a little bit cut off, and other times it's more like the base no suffix chip with a little bit thrown on, and other times it's been this weird middle ground.
Yeah, it's been all over the place.
Yeah, maybe Apple doesn't know if the Pro chip has a place in its line. Maybe, I mean, Apple would know, and we wouldn't. Like, maybe most MacBook Pro buyers buy the Max or they buy the base, and a lot of people don't buy the Pro. So I find this rumor fascinating because of the new chip tech and how this might affect things. If, you know, Vadim's thing of saying, oh, it's the same chip or whatever, I think they would just call them by different names. Even if they mix and match a different CPU and GPU combo, that's basically an M5 Pro. Or it could just be that this build didn't have the code name in it because the other two leaked and there was an if-def that got missed somewhere. Like, who knows? But I this is making me even more interested in what these chips are going to look like. If there really is no Pro, I personally would be fine with that because all I care about is, like, the high-end and low-end chips. But I wonder if, like, Mac Mini owners and stuff would be like, hey, I kind of like the Pro because it was a nice happy medium between paying through the nose for the Macs or getting the base chip. What do you guys think?
I have found, like, you know, as I've looked at different, you know, Macs over the, you know, since the Apple Silicon transition and as I've been making buying decisions, I have never found the Pro to be quite what I'm looking for, because it does end up costing a significant amount more than the base chip. But it doesn't have all of the high capacity support and all the highest performance of the Macs. And I have found that, like, with the Pro, in at least in the current lineup, like in the M4 lineup, which I know we're kind of split now, we have some of the M5 lineup, but in the M4 lineup, the base M4 got so good that I think it left very little reason for the Pro to exist. Because if you actually look at, like, performance per dollar, the base M4 is a really great value, and the Pro really is not. It does not scale up that well to you know, performance per dollar as you go up that list. And the Max serves the role of, like, I need big resource support. I need all the ports, all the bandwidth, you know, whatever it, you know, whatever that is. The Max serves that role. Yeah, but the Pro, it kind of sits in the middle of those. And you end up paying a lot more for only some of those benefits. And I don't think that's really a strong selling proposition with the current lineup. But as you mentioned, though, past generations of Pros before the M4 have been very different from each other. Like the M1 Pro was very different from the M2 Pro, and like they've had different core counts and different balances of things.
Yeah, the M1 Pro was basically an M1 Max with a little bit cut off. Like, literally, yeah. They just took, just went snip, 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 cut off some GPU cores. Hey, M2 Pro, M1 Pro. It was so close to the Max.
Yeah, and then was it the M3 Pro that had the really weird proportion of PDE cores,
like,
that was on
more,
like, everything
efficiency
else?
Efficiency cores, and it was like this whole big custom design.
Yeah, like it seems like they're doing. It doesn't seem like making a custom design for the Pro is necessarily worth it. And I think by having the base chips, the regular M chips, get pushed up in performance so much. Again, like, look at the M4. Compared to the M4 Pro and M4 Max, the M4 really stands out as a really great bang for the buck compared to the other two. And also, I wonder if this might play in a little bit to their, you know, the rumored upcoming less expensive MacBook that is rumored to have an A series phone chip as its CPU. I wonder if maybe the regular M chip, the M4, M5, those might be actually being elevated upwards in the product line too, that maybe we're going to start seeing more very low-end products using the A series chips from the phone, even in the Mac line, and maybe more in the iPad line. And then the M chip is actually more of a mid-range thing, and then you have the M Max chip as the high-end, and then the M Ultra for the one that they very occasionally make for the products they forgot about.
They should just rename the plain old M6 chip to just be M6 Pro, and there is no suffix M6.
I mean, who knows? They might.
Like, from a marketing perspective, like, why not? Because I agree with you. Like, if the low-end laptop is successful with the phone chip in it, they're going to do more of that. And it makes sense. Like, I think it's a good idea, right? I think that product is a good idea, and I think that strategy is a good idea. I think the naming is a little bit weird with it, you know, being an A-series chip and confusing people, so they might need to work that out. But, like, you can fix naming, right? So if they don't want to make the Pro anymore, just call the base M6 M6 Pro. Like, just do it. Like,
well, I don't think that's necessarily need. I mean, the reality is these M chips have gotten a reputation, well deserved, for being really strong performers. So maybe the M chip doesn't need the same M naming line to cover the entire product line anymore.
Aren't you glad they didn't do a BMW thing when they first laid out this line and just have, like, year after year they would have, you know, the M3, the M5, the M7, and occasionally the M8, and, like, you know, like, every year they would have that and we had to put year suffixes on them. Like, yep. I'm proud of them for sticking with a letter and a number, and then each time they make a new line of chips, increasing the number. Like, good job, Apple. I know that was hard to figure that out after a few decades, but they figured it out. But I do wonder if they're gonna they can't help self sabotaging with the A series chips, yeah, and Mac, right, and the M series chips and iPads, right? We had it was all clean, everything was worked out, but now what does the M stand for? MyPad?
I mean, it's also possible that, you know, if the rumored, you know, less expensive MacBook using the phone class chip is true, it's also possible they might not call it the A17 or whatever it would be. They might call they'd call it like
the M0.
Maybe it'd be like, you know, the M5 Express, you know, who knows, like M5 Air.
M5
there we
SE.
Go. They would just call it the M5 Air, and then that would be confusing with the M-powered iPad Air,
the
MacBook Air.
Yeah, but SE hasn't been used for chips either. Yeah, I don't know.
Oh, SE's good. The M5 SE.
Or, like, you know, they didn't want to call the ultra wideband chip the U2. They did, like, once or twice, but now they're back to not calling it that anymore.
Yeah. Anyway, I think they have a lot of options here for naming. But regardless, I do think that the base M series chip is no longer a low end chip. I mean, it kind of never was performance wise, but it's really a very solid mid range chip by most measures. And
yeah,
so for them to elevate that,
like,
I think that's actually reasonable.
Like, a lot of these recent reviews I've been reading of the latest releases from Intel and AMD for their laptops and stuff, you know, they Panther Lake or whatever thing, they come up with, like, it's finally they got a good chip, it's made on a good process or whatever, and here are the benchmarks, and they show all these graphs or whatever, and you're watching, I'm like, wow, Intel's really doing well. And you realize every single one of the graphs is against the base M4. You're like, but you know, Apple makes other chips, like other chips that are in laptops. Like, it's not like, oh, it's not a fair fight. You can't put it up against an M5 Ultra or something. Like, no, just, you know, the other laptop chips. Like, so that the rest of the industry is so proud when they have a chip that performs better than Apple's base M4.
Yeah,
they're like so happy. It's like victory lap, parade, you know, party parades down the streets. And it's like, you beat their lowest end Mac chip by a little bit.
Yeah, because the base M4 is awesome. Like, that's what I have in my travel laptop, and it's amazing. Like, I have never really needed more grunt out of that for those needs, and that includes oftentimes using Xcode and making apps. I mean, you know, obviously we'll see with the thing that we're not talking about, you know, if that ends up ramping up the demand for local resources. But actually, if you do a lot of cloud based things we're not talking about, which most of them are so far, that actually might reduce the need for local processing power. So, you know, we'll see how this all shakes out. But
yeah,
the M4 is awesome, and I haven't had any time to play with the M5, but it is probably awesome as well.
It is solidly
a middle class chip. It is not it isn't a low end chip at all.
Yeah, and I imagine the M6, once it gets the process transition to the 2-nanometer, is going to be even more impressive. So look forward to that for your OLED laptop sometime, supposedly within this calendar year, if the rumors are to be believed.
All right. Are we good? We want to do some Ask ATP? We haven't done that in a while.
It's built up. We have a lot of it in here.
All right. I think we're only going to do a little bit tonight because we got a lot of other stuff to attend to. But Alan Scholl writes, the recent winter storm has me seriously thinking about whole house generators and batteries. If I remember correctly, Casey uses a gas generator and Marco has installed rooftop solar recently. So what's best? Would it make sense to have a whole house battery backup without a solar installation? So let me talk about what I've got going on. For short outages, which let me back up, actually, it's very rare for us to lose power here. Very, very rare. It used to happen all the time. And then I think there were some overground power lines that were running through some trees, and the power company cut the trees back a lot. And now it's been very unusual for us to lose power. But if we were to lose power, and if it was only for a few hours, especially if it's a weather event, so I know that it's coming, then I'll take that tailgate battery that we use. So this is something that I got inspired to buy from Jason Snell. It's a, I don't know, like 15-pound battery pack that has a couple of AC outlets on it, a couple of USB-C outlets on it, et cetera. And that's enough to run the fridge. I've never tried it, but based on like power draw specifications, I expect I could run the fridge for probably a better part of a day, maybe even two on that thing. And I could also, you know, plug in a lamp or something like that. So for a short thing, if you only ever lose power for a little bit of time, I'd say a portable battery pack might just do the trick. And this thing is like $200 or $300, maybe $400 at the most right now. It's reasonably, I mean, it's a lot of money, but it's reasonably affordable. But then on top of that, we have a very physically large, physically heavy, pretty powerful gas generator that was, figuratively speaking, bequeathed to us from my parents. What had happened was they live in an area where they do lose power a lot. And so they had this something like 5,000 watt sustained, 7,000 peak gasoline generator. It's a Honda inverter generator, so it produces like a near perfect sine wave, et cetera, et cetera. I would never have spent the like $5,000 that they spent on this thing 10 years ago when it was new. But if they're offering it to me for free, hell yeah. So that is in the garage, and we have a generator interlock in the fuse box and so on and so forth. So I haven't ever tried this. And in fact, just this Monday when I went and drove the Taycan, I almost did a little experiment since I was the only one in the house. And I really want to try figuring out how much of the house I can run off that generator, because I think I can do darn near everything in the house and maybe even one of the two HVAC systems in the house if I turn on the natural gas heat. You know, we wouldn't run AC, but if in the cold weather, I wonder if I force the furnace to natural gas, because it's a heat pump and then natural gas, I wonder if I might be able to run the furnace in emergency heat mode if we really got in a pinch. But worst case scenario, we could use a space heater or something like that. But that's my situation. To answer Alan's question, my personal opinion is, if you can do rooftop solar with like a Powerwall or equivalent or something like that, that's probably the bestest answer, because it serves you the most time. You know, you can use that pretty much all year round. But that is incredibly expensive, incredibly expensive. If you lose power constantly, then a Generac, like a whole home Generac or equivalent, I think is a really good idea. But if you just lose power occasionally, I would really figure out, you know, what is it you absolutely need to survive? A fridge or two, a couple of lights, something like that. And figure out if a small like tailgate generator or portable tailgate style battery like I have, would that be enough to sustain you for a day or two? Because doing a Generac, doing whole home solar, even buying one of these large gasoline powered generators is a lot. And in the case of the generator, like I have to start it every few months. I have to check the oil, you know, I have to make sure when I do start it, I run all the gas out of it, et cetera, et cetera. So it is a lot of work for something that I only ever use once every few years.
Wow. That was a really good answer. I actually don't have a ton more to add about that. I can tell you my experience with solar. What Casey just said is very important. A generator is a lifestyle. Like, yeah. My in-laws have a generator. Whenever we're visiting them, you know, if we happen to be visiting, I believe it's like Wednesday at noon. You know, like once a week, it has to turn on and test itself, and so you want it. It makes a whole bunch of noise.
Talking about a whole home generator,
yes,
like a generator
sorry,
or something
yeah,
like that.
Exactly, yes. And because you know they live in a very rural area, and so they actually end up you know needing that sometimes. And you know it's a whole thing. Like it's a very physically large thing. It's a very loud thing if it's ever needed to be running, and it needs to run itself to test itself every so often. As Casey said, you know, it's a gas engine. You got to like maintain it like a gas engine. So it's a whole thing. Generators do have the advantage over solar and batteries that, first of all, if you happen to have a gas pipeline to your house, like from your town, if you have natural gas service, you can have that connected to that, and then you kind of have an infinite supply, you know, infrastructure asterisks and everything. But like, you effectively have an infinite supply, so you don't have to like go buy fuel and keep a fuel tank and you know go refill it, and you know, so there is an interesting you know side effect there.
And actually, let me jump in really quickly. Yeah. Something I didn't consider about the freestanding gasoline generator that I have. When we had this real bad snowstorm, I got a burr up my butt that we were going to lose power for 17 weeks, and so I filled something like, I think we have like a 5-gallon gas can and like a 2 or 3 gallon gas can. I filled both those bad boys because I'm like, I am going to be okay during this storm. Like, it'll be fine.
I'm going to turn my garage into even more of a bomb.
Right, exactly. Well, the thing of it is, though, in a normal summer season, we'll go through maybe like 3 or 4 gallons of gas. And I now have like 8 gallons of gas sitting in my garage. So what am I going to do with the rest of it? I can stabilize it. I can run it through the generator for funsies or whatever. Like now I have different problem.
I mean, can you pour it into Aaron's car?
Yeah, don't put it in that car. That car never uses the gas.
Oh, yeah, right. Pour it into your car.
That's true.
Yeah.
But no, well, first of all, both our cars take premiums. Second of all, I'm too nerdy about...
You didn't get premium for the generator?
No.
And you should have thought about reusing it.
Yeah,
your
right.
car, well, even though your cars require premium, they'll run on regular, right?
Yeah, like trash.
Also, knock sensors. They'll figure it out. Mm. The engine computers are smart.
Anyway, and on top of that, I'm too much of a nerd with regard to mileage tracking and things like that. So that's a non-answer, or non-starter.
So you're not going to... All right, well, I guess you can just let it sit in your garage, which is a better choice than putting it in your car.
Well, coincidentally, what I've decided is I told some friends of ours, some local friends of ours, that I was going to put the excess gas into the wife's Ford Explorer because they are good to their cars, but they don't care like I do. So anyways.
they'll take your filthy gas. You should have just made like a lemonade stand out at the end of your driveway. It says free gas. Cars drive by, you just... Put it in the tank.
Just put it a little. Here's a dollar. But anyways, I apologize for interrupting, Marco, and I'd love you to continue. But it's just another thing to think about with a freestanding generator. This is not what you're talking about with like a natural gas Generac sort of situation. Yeah. But for mine, I now have too much gasoline and have to do something with it.
Yeah. So that's you know, the generator lifestyle. It's involved. It's very imposing into your physical space and into the noise and into maintenance and fuel needs and everything. The advantage of generators over solar is, again, you tend to have, like, you know, if you can get a natural gas pipeline, you can run it 24/7 and you won't run out. And also, you tend to be able to power larger amounts of wattage for less money. The main downside of solar panels with batteries is that if you, like, you have to, what Casey was just saying was important, you have to figure out what exactly you're trying to replace. What level of power? Are you trying to run your entire house? And does that include things like a water heater? And most importantly, does that include heating and air conditioning? If you're running your heat and air conditioning and they are electric or heat pump, you're going to need a lot of power for that. That's going to be way more power than your fridge, your outlets, your lights. You know, like if all you need is fridge, outlets, and lights, you can get away with a much smaller setup. But if you're trying to power your thermal control of the house, your HVAC system, and if you live somewhere that has very hot or very cold weather and you want it to work enough for that, you need a lot of power to do that. And for that, if that is your setup, I haven't looked at prices recently. I'll get to that in a second. But that might be too much power to have a reasonably affordable setup with batteries. If you have to run it from solar and you have to run it overnight and it's really cold that night and you have to make a lot of heat, that just might be too much power to do that with a reasonable number of batteries in your garage or whatever. So that being said, that might not be what you need. You might not need all of that. And you might... When I bought my system, it was 2019 when I ordered and bought my solar... So my solar system at the beach is... something like, I think, like 90 kilowatts. On a good day, it produces like 95 or 100 kilowatts of power. So whatever the wattage for the solar panels is, maybe it's that. So on a good summer sunny day, I'm going to run 100 or 90 kilowatt production. Or kilowatt hour production, I think. Yeah. And I have two Tesla Powerwall 2s before they were known to be a horrible company run by horrible people. There's two Powerwall 2s, which I think are 11 kilowatts hours of storage each, something like that. But that was in 2019, and that cost a decent amount of money. Today, though, the costs of all of that stuff have gone way, way down since then. I don't know what they cost today because I haven't priced it out recently, but it's way cheaper. Now, you do run into limits with how much battery storage you are allowed to have based on local building codes, fire codes, electrical codes. So there are other limits to consider. And so I can't tell you what your limit is. It's different in different places. It's different depending on what kind of space the batteries are in. Are they inside? Are they outside? Are they in conditioned space? Are they in a garage? You know, there's all these different, you know, rules and regulations of how much of a lithium ion bomb you can have in your house. Because that's what energy storage is. It's a bomb of, you know, various types. Gas is the same way. Anyway. So there's all these different limits of how much battery storage you can have. The solar panels themselves are really inexpensive for what you get now. And I can strongly recommend having solar power for lots of reasons. Climate is a really good, like, you know, climate change reduction is a great reason. Just general, like, energy renewability. It's a great thing to have solar panels on your house if you have a situation where that's reasonably possible. It's a great thing to do. Mine do not cover my entire electricity need, but that's because we use a lot of electricity, especially, like, you know, if we're running, like, the hot tub heater, that uses a ton of power. So, like, there's, you know, but it offsets it all, and it's great. One of the great advantages of the battery system, though, for backup power in some kind of, you know, situation where you have a storm or you have a power outage, the great thing about that system is that as long as you don't need the entire power plus of all the batteries every day, which you won't because you wouldn't size it that way, you effectively then have infinite recharging because you can use the power from the batteries all night, and all day your solar panels are topping them off. So my setup at the beach is that, like, having just the two power walls is not enough to run our HVAC and hot water heater and everything, so we don't have those connected to it. We have them connected to a whole bunch of lights, outlets, fridge, ice maker, all my networking equipment, all the Wi-Fi gear, the Reddit, all that stuff, and a few kind of like critical appliances and stuff. We've never run out of power. Like, we've had a few days long power outages, and we use the power at night. And then by, like, 9 a.m., the batteries are back at 100% from just the solar input. And unlike generators, you never really have to think about the system. There's no moving parts. It produces no noise. They need no maintenance. I have never touched the system since it was installed in 2019. And so from a, like, reliability, simplicity, elegance perspective, solar plus batteries is awesome. It's way better than a generator. The only problem is, again, can you get enough battery capacity to power what you need to power overnight? That's the big challenge. But if you can get past that, or if you can get away with powering not your entire house, maybe you don't need your entire AC system to be running at full blast all night long, and then there somehow to be no sun all day, like, you can get away, if you can get away with the budgeting of that, it's an amazing setup, and I strongly recommend it.
I would have had a shorter answer to this question, which is, does it make sense to have a whole house battery without a solar installation? No, doesn't make sense. Because if you're looking at whole house battery backup, you're already spending a huge amount of money. Get the solar panels. Just get them. Like, I know they'll be cheaper next year and cheaper the next year still, but they're pretty cheap now. Get the solar. 100%. Like, if you're even considering a quote-unquote whole house battery backup, subject to the caveats that Marco just put in about what you'll actually be allowed to install, yes, absolutely get the solar. I don't think it makes sense without it. Unless you have the ability to bury a giant hypersonic vacuum sealed flywheel in your yard and use that for energy storage.
Which also
which
has
is
problems.
Less of a bomb than batteries or gasoline.
Oh, no, it's just a kinetic bomb.
No, because it's underground, so when it explodes, it just the dirt protects you.
Yeah, oh, okay. Have you seen, like...
It spins sideways, not vertically.
Okay.
I mean, in any case.
There's other issues.
It goes out sideways, you see?
But yeah, and
it's fine.
Again, I haven't priced this out recently, but I would expect that the solar panels part of it is probably cheaper than the batteries part of it these days.
Like, right, and boy, what a better investment. For sure, yeah. A better investment.
I mean, ideally, you know, if you can get both components, they work very well together, and it's wonderful.
Yes, exactly. But, if you're just thinking about, like, what Casey was saying, like a battery that, like, can power some of your appliances that you can roll around or whatever, then I would say, like, oh, well, solar panels are going to be a lot of money. But if you're even considering anything that you call a whole house battery, get some solar panels.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And again, I think I said this earlier, but just to reiterate, if you are in a situation where you've lost power, you shouldn't likely think of this as how can I get my normal life back to me? What you should think about is what are the bare essentials to keep you and your family functioning, right? And generally speaking, I would say that includes HVAC, but in this scenario, I would say it doesn't. But that probably potentially includes hot water, depending on if it's electric or not, and certainly includes like a few lights, maybe a space heater, something, your refrigerators, things of that nature.
Yeah. And also, you know, one other thing too, like if you're deciding between solar and generators, keep in mind that all the rest of the time when you are not having this rare event of this, you know, having like a power cut shortage or storm or whatever, all the rest of the time, your solar panels are producing power saving you money and is saving the world. And meanwhile, your generator is sitting there doing nothing except losing value and slowly needing maintenance. So that does also probably sway the decision a little bit. Like, solar panels provide constant value whether you need that value at that moment or not. They're always providing that value. Especially if you have
the infinite source of power that you have going through a natural gas line to your house is substantially less infinite than the light of the sun.
Exactly.
Yes, like, even when it's cloudy and raining.
Yeah, because even when it's cloudy and raining in January, I'm still making like 20 or 30 kilowatt hours a day. There's a lot of power generation to be had by pointing things at the sun. Like, when the incremental cost of having them on your roof every day is nothing, you can gain a lot of value over time. It's wonderful. Definitely. Like, if you can install solar on your house, you should do it for lots of reasons. Whether you need to power your entire life, as Casey was saying, for indefinitely or not, that's up to you. I would also just merely suggest, like, if the context is like, well, we shouldn't get solar because we might someday need, the heat in the winter on some awful outage and my family needs it to survive. Like, well, for the cost of that incremental gain of power, you can buy a lot of hotel rooms. So how often would that actually be necessary? Like, you'll be fine. But anyway, yeah, get solar. It's really good.
All right, Kevin B. writes, why are you feeling positive about John Ternus potentially taking over CEO of Apple? You all very much disapprove of what Tim Cook has been doing lately, and I don't disagree. By all accounts, John Ternus is Tim Cook's choice to replace him one day. If you disagree so strongly with Tim Cook's decisions, why are you okay with this one? I have nothing against John Ternus. It just seems like there's a disconnect between Tim Cook is making awful decisions and needs to go, and Tim Cook's decision to select John Ternus to replace him is good and exciting.
I don't think that's that big of a disconnect. Like, just because Tim Cook has selected him doesn't mean the person he's selecting agrees with everything Tim Cook does and will do exactly what Tim Cook did. I mean, Steve Jobs picked Tim Cook and they were very different CEOs. So our expectation, our hope, is that John Ternus will be different than Tim Cook in the same way that Tim Cook was different than Steve Jobs. Now, he could be worse, could be better, could be worse. But, like, we're hopeful because the things we hear are good. You know, like, we want to be hopeful. Like, but the real point is, I think we've all basically resigned ourselves to the fact that nothing about what we dislike about what Tim Cook is doing is ever going to change until he leaves. So he has to leave. So if you want to think of it this way, you can say it's not so much that we're excited about John Ternus coming, as we're excited about Tim Cook leaving. And, and we feel like anything's got to be, like, it's the only chance we have for improvement. And I think it's a little bit of both, because, again, we have very little info on John Ternus, so that is, we've said that before, like, we don't actually know. He's been in presentations for years. We see him on stage talking, but, like, he's more of a cipher. He doesn't have a track record that we know of other than he was in charge of hardware, and hardware is great, right? But I'm personally optimistic, mostly because a transition, a departure, a change in leadership is the best opportunity for things to potentially get better. And I'm currently choosing to believe that they won't get worse. We'll see.
Yeah, I mean, it's the reality is that we don't know and we can't know what kind of CEO John Ternus will be. Again, assuming he is the next CEO, that's a big disclaimer, but it does seem fairly likely. We don't know. But I think we are ready for change in so many ways from Tim Cook. I think Tim Cook has shown us everything he can do, positive and negative. He's shown us what he's really good at. He's shown us what he's not so good at. And I think Apple's in a bit of a tough spot right now. Like, I don't think Apple's going to have a very good year. I think Tim Cook has made a bunch of strategic decisions over time that are coming home to roost. The over-reliance on China is really bad. The cozying up to Trump is really bad. And by, the recent Apple News bias thing, not really helping. Like, not really buying him anything, just giving into the bully more and more. How often does that ever help? Never. So you have those two problems. You have the underinvestment in AI, which is still... sorry, we were supposed to talk about that. but it's, like, that's a huge deal. I'm telling you, I've been saying for a while now, this is Steve Ballmer missing mobile. This is Apple's version of that. Like, Tim Cook blew AI, instead making a car and a VR helmet and the car never shipped, thank God. And the VR helmet is, you know, limping and not, it turns out, not where the next big thing was. And then totally blew the actual next big thing, which is AI. I think Apple really would benefit in this moment from a significant change in leadership. And so I am very much looking forward to that happening for so many reasons. I mean, look, the regulatory stuff with the App Store control and anti-competitive behavior. I mean, there's so much that Apple has been squeezing the wrong way or blowing the wrong way. Oh, God, this is going badly. There's a lot of things that the Tim Cook era is not good at handling or has squeezed every ounce of life out of that are really hurting the company's long-term prospects. And I think this is going to be a really bad year for them in a lot of ways. I think they have a lot of humble pie that they're going to be eating. And I think by the time Tim Cook actually goes, if it happens in the next year or two, I think a lot more people than me are going to be saying, yeah, it's time. This is a welcome change. So yeah. Whether John Ternus will be a great successor, we don't know yet. But look, Steve Jobs, who was pretty good in this role, picked Tim Cook, who is, you know, pretty mixed in this role. Steve Jobs and Tim Cook are nothing alike. They're very different people. Steve Jobs did not have an amazing ability to pick successors for himself. but also, like, when you look at the pool of people that they have to choose from at that level, it's a pretty short list. Like, when Steve Jobs realized he had to, you know, hand off the company, how many people was he going to choose from? Like, Tim Cook was the obvious choice. We all knew it at the time, even before we knew how bad Steve's condition was and how little time he had left. We were all saying at the time, of course it's going to be Tim Cook. Like, that was very obvious, and there weren't that many other clearly good options at that time. Well, now, Tim Cook looking for a successor, like, there's not that many good choices. There's not many, that many plausible, you know, realistic choices that would actually, you know, be good and aren't, you know, as old as Tim, and who would want the job and who would be good at the job. So the fact that Tim is picking seemingly John Ternus doesn't necessarily say that, you know, that there were, you know, 20 people on the list and Tim thought Ternus was going to be the most like him. It doesn't say that at all. I think the list is much smaller than that of practical options. And I don't think when people choose a successor, I don't think they are necessarily that good at finding someone just like them or that that would be what they would be looking for necessarily.
Yeah, yeah. Also, I think implicit in this question is an assertion or an assumption that we disagree with everything, every single thing that Tim Cook does. And I don't think that's true. We certainly lately have disagreed with a lot, but I wouldn't say that I at least disagree with literally everything that Tim Cook does.
No, none of us
possible,
do.
It is very possible for us to simultaneously say decision A is bad and decision B was great. So I don't think this is incongruous at all, personally. Carl Walther writes, on episode 675, John was talking about the confusion that would be caused if common menu items had inconsistent names. I'm a lifelong Windows user that came to the Mac 5 years ago. Recently, I was working with an image in preview, and I wanted to rename the image to separate it from the original image. Instead of Save As, Duplicate is the default menu item, with Save As available as an alt click. It is worth noting, however, that is also Option. You know, you can hit Option and click as well. Why is Duplicate the default Mac workflow? The workflow I'm used to is to use Save As to create a new file, which is a copy of the old one, but with the new name, keeping the same window I was working in, keeping inside the same window I was working in. John, what's going on here?
The menu item is Duplicate, not
yes.
Duplicate.
Oh, sorry, I was wondering how long you'd let him do that.
An Option yes. is Alt. They're just a Windows user, and they think it's Alt. I know it says Alt on the key. It drives me nuts. Alt-Tab, which is Command-Tab, not Option-Tab. Anyway,
Actually, so, it should be the Windows key, because if you go by consistent placement, you should be remapping your Windows keyboard, which is one of the ones I use.
Key added years later than it should have been when Microsoft finally got around to copying Apple in one more regard, and they still managed to screw it up.
Yeah, there was just a weird gap there before in PC keyboards.
Right, and so they... So this change, like, going from a world where you had Save and Save As in the file menu to the world where you have Duplicate in that menu item and all these option, you know, all these key combinations that you can press to change those menu items to other things. This happened in 2012. I'll put a link in the show notes to my macOS 10.8 Mountain Lion review from 2012. That's when this was rolled out. And the idea behind it is hopefully still explained clearly in that article. Is that, hey, iPhones and iPads and other things, people love those. And they have a different model for dealing with documents than the Mac does. And people seem to really like it. And if you're wondering what that model is, take out your phone, open the Notes app, and use it. How does that work? Is there a save menu in there anyway? Do you have to remember to save in Notes? Are your changes unsaved and you can decide, no, never mind, I'm just going to close this note and not save those changes? No, that's not how the Notes app work. That's not how any apps on iOS or iPad have ever really worked. They've always been like, it's just a live thing. You don't have to worry about files or saving. And that's very in line with what people expect if it's what you're used to. And that was on the phone. And the bright idea around this era of 10.7 and 10.8 is like, things people love about the phone and the iPad, we should bring them to the Mac. The problem is the Mac is not the phone or the iPad, but they did. They brought it. They said, we're gonna have a new paradigm for our document model on the Mac, and we're going to have a bunch of new APIs, and we're going to have new conventions, and we're going to show you how it's done by, like, here's text edit, and there's no more save or save as option or whatever. We're going to have documents that automatically save. We're going to automatically save versions in this janky SQLite database that's off to the side, and you'll be able to roll back versions, so don't worry. It's not like you're going to lose your changes. You can always go back from one version to the other, but you don't have to worry about saving anymore. And they pitched this real hard. They had WWDC sessions on it. They did it to their own apps to demonstrate, here's how it's done. Here's what we think the future is. Like, you know, just don't worry if you have unsaved documents. Just quit the app and relaunch it. Your documents will be back right where they were. Don't worry about saving. We're always saving. And don't worry about getting back past versions. We can always show you the past versions. And, you know, again, that was 2012. Here we are in 2026, and I can tell you, it did not stick. Mac users did not universally laud and adopt this new model. Independent Mac developers did not universally adopt it and say it's great and never look back at that old crappy model. And this is despite the fact that everybody still loves their phones and everybody still loves their iPads, and there are Mac apps that work this way that people really like. But it was not universally adopted. And maybe it's just because people are old and then we all need to die. But, like,
wow,
you know, like the habits that were formed in the stone age of the PC, which is that you open a document in your document-based application and you do stuff in it. And if you change your mind, you can just close that window and say, don't save these changes. And you know you haven't modified the document on disk. The capabilities I just described are still there in the model Apple introduced. They're just presented differently, and my impression is that not just developers, not just old people, but the general public kind of rejected them for certain classes of applications on the Mac. For other classes of applications, they work. Notes on the Mac works just like it does on the phone. There's no saving, there's no documents, no reverting, and people love it, and it works fine. But for things like Adobe Photoshop or Microsoft Word or all these other applications, they've been always like dabbling in that area. Well, we'll work that way because Apple says we want to work that way, but we do have some cranky users who don't want it to work that way, so maybe we'll give you options on what should the defaults be, and we're not going to use Apple's versions thing. Are you even familiar with this feature? It's so like poorly adopted on the Mac. I'm always wondering if it's even still there. Do you know what I'm talking about, the versions thing?
I know it's there. I've never successfully used it.
Isn't it like a mini time machine presentation for just the document you're working on or something like that?
Yeah, like it's the problem with that feature has kind of been like the whole idea is if you have autosave. You don't have to be saving. It'll always be saving in the background. You don't have to worry about it. And if you want to get back a change before, like you open a document, you make some changes, you're like, oh, no, I changed my mind. I don't want any of this. I can't get back to the old version because those were all autosaved and I deleted a bunch of stuff and I could, you know, hold down Command Z for a long time. But maybe the undo buffer is gone because I opened and closed the document. Or something like, I changed my mind. How can I get that back? The idea is that while the app is auto-saving, every old version of the document, like version control style, is saved somewhere, and you can just go back to earlier. This is not Time Machine. This is literally saving like the diffs and chunks in this weird SQLite database. I think it's SQLite. Off to the side somewhere like this. This was, and I believe still is, built into macOS, and you would access it either through the menus or you could do a modifier click on the title of the thing in the title bar. Like, but again, it never really caught on. The implementation was janky and not great, and the UI for presenting it was inconsistent. It changed a lot, and just people never really latched onto it. It's like, look, there's two worlds. There's the iPhone world, where you don't have to worry about any of this stuff, and lots of apps in the Mac do that these days. And there's the old world, which is like PCs, where you have file, open, save, blah, blah, blah. The only thing this change really did was teach a whole swath of the public the weird finger modifier combos to get save as back, because that's what everybody wanted. They're like, just Google for how do I get save as back on the Mac? You'll find a million results. Like, this is a widely shared tip since 2012, because people were like, I used to know how computers worked, and I just want that back. And again, maybe it's just the stubbornness, and all these people just need to, like, live out their lives and die, and then we'll enter the brave new world where everything autosaves. But I just feel like Apple's heart hasn't really been in it. Like, they haven't advanced and continued pushing this, despite the fact that if you go to text edit today, I believe this is still the default of how it works.
Yeah, I still get it in preview. That's where I see it the most.
Preview drives me nuts with that. There's a bunch of other things that preview does that drive me off the wall, too. But yeah, no, text edit, you've got save, duplicate, rename, move to, revert. I believe you have the versioning thing still in the accessible somewhere. I forget where that is hiding. Like, you don't hear much about it. Like, Apple isn't, like, hammering on it like they were back in, like, 2012, 2013, 2014 of saying, you need to adopt this. This is the modern way. Forget about that old open save, closed documents out saving. That's not it. Just we want all the apps in the Mac to work like they do on iOS. And it's just been, like, unevenly adopted. And what has resulted in is people like Carl seeing this and saying, what's going on the Mac? Like, Is this how everything is in the Mac, or just some things? And why are some things like this, and why are they not? And why do I have to learn the modifier clicks to get save as back? I think it's actually it's just option. But it changes duplicated, but then other options. Like, it's inconsistent in a way that it wasn't before, because they weren't able to transition the Mac platform from the old model to the new one. So now we just have both of them. Which might sound familiar if you have tracked the history of window management on the Mac either. Just saying, they introduce a new system, but the old one doesn't go away, and now you have both, which in some ways is, you know, useful. But the problem is, with every app that you use now on the Mac, if it's not doing what you expect, you'll be startled. Because again, stickies and notes do what people expect, and they never have to think about it. But text edit maybe doesn't work the way you expect, because you expect it to work the old way because it's just a simple text editor, but it doesn't. It works the new way. And the same thing with preview, where you're like, wait, is this saved? Do I want to duplicate? And like, oh, I made a change, but like, I just saw the preview icon change on the desktop, but I didn't hit save. I guess preview doesn't work like I thought it did. I guess it just auto-saves. Or what if I want the old version back? I guess I should have duplicated first. And is there a version feature in preview, and how do I access it? It's not a great situation in the Mac. Like, I understand what Apple was trying to do, but I think their transition essentially failed, and then they lost interest in it.
Yeah, this has bitten me constantly. Preview is by far the most common time I run into it. Oftentimes, it'll be like, I'm opening an image, I want to resize it and save a smaller copy. And so often, yeah, I open it up, I resize it, I just overwrote the original with a smaller version of itself. Thanks so much.
You didn't save, but you're like, surely nothing happens until I save. Nope, that's right. Not the way preview works. It works like notes.
And I think the example of notes is a good one. The reason why we don't have save in notes, I think conceptually, that is not at odds with wanting the old file save behavior in preview, because notes, you're not operating on files. Notes is a kind of like, you know, solid data store. You are operating on a database inside the app. They're also sometimes called shoebox apps. Like, when you are using notes, it does not work like open a file, edit the file, save the file, because you're not operating on files. Whereas the reason why this new document model, new being 2012, is so confusing, and has been since 2012 when they introduced it, is because the entire history of PCs, when you are operating on files, works the old way. And when phones came around, with phone apps that inspired like this new behavior, phone apps don't work on files, at least most of them, you know, and certainly now there's a few, but, you know, as we get into like, you know, the iPad being a power user thing, but for the most part, phone apps don't work on files. Phone apps work on databases and services. And so it is consistent that you can say you don't have to save in notes. Yeah, because notes, you're not dealing with files. But the workflow of people using PCs, Windows and Mac, forever has been, when you are operating on a file, you can open that file, you can edit it, and it shows a little unsaved indicator somewhere. Maybe, you know, the dot on Mac. I don't know what the heck PCs do. It doesn't matter. and you can save the file. And if you try to close the file without saving, it'll ask you, do you want to save what you did? And you can save it, or you can save as, or you can discard it. And Apple said, we're going to change that. Now, the problem with changing that is that you're taking a model that everyone has already learned and not only throwing it away, but replacing it with a model that looks the same until you've destroyed data. Like, it looks, and yeah, you can revert, but no, and most people don't know that, or it's hard, or it's clunky. Like, we already had a model for this, and it's kind of like, and I'm sorry, John, you're going to hate this, it's kind of like the file extensions debate, where Mac...
You mean file name extensions.
Yes, sorry. Where Mac file names don't natively need extensions, and the old Mac didn't even have them, and then, you know, Windows PCs use file extensions to indicate types of files and provide associations to whatever app should open it. And over time, like the pressure from the Windows world for Macs to work the same way as people know how to use them, and they'd have good interoperability with PC files, kind of required Macs, just by kind of market pressure, to adopt file name extensions. And
or
it's
that's
not,
what the people who did it tell themselves so they can sleep at night.
Wow. And it's not, you know, it's not the most graceful thing in the world. And of course, Apple did it their Apple way, which is, well, we're going to have file extensions, but we're going to hide them sometimes. And just to confuse the way things work, we're just going to have some file extensions that never show up, like, you know, like project, like bundles.app and stuff. And we're going to have some file extensions that show up only if you typed them in when you saved the file, but not if you didn't. And then we're going to prompt you to change it even when it's not there visibly. It's again, like, Apple tried to do something, you know, pretty and theoretically maybe a little bit uniform, and the real-world complexity of it is kind of annoying. Well, the document model introduced in 2012 is an even larger version of that problem, where they tried to do something that is different from the way PCs and previous Macs worked, and no one really wanted it. None of the rest of the world works that way, including the iPhone. Like, it was one of the many features where the iPhone succeeds or the iPad succeeds, and Apple's like, we should unify the behavior between iOS and Macs, and that hardly ever has been a good idea and has hardly ever resulted in positive change. Sometimes it has, but overall, like, every time they've tried to you know, unify the behavior by basically clobbering what was there on the Mac before with a copy of what's on iOS, it doesn't usually work out that well because they're different platforms. They work very differently. Their users have different expectations and different habits and different needs. Anyway, so this is one of those things where, like, we had a model that worked that everyone was familiar with, and they tried to replace it. No one adopted it, really, except Apple's own built-in apps, and even then, only some of them. And so what we have now is this confusing mess, and Apple is probably too proud to ever change it back in their apps, to ever go back to this, or to, as far as I know, there's still, like, no system-wide option to change it back, is there?
No, but they added so many APIs for this and so many systems, but I just feel like they lost interest in them, especially the versioning stuff.
Well, I think the market just said, we don't care. We don't want that, because
but, I mean,
users
some
said we don't
do
want that.
Some apps do use it. Like, it's that's the thing. Like, they can't get rid of it now because some apps do actually use it and rely on it. They just painted themselves into a corner. It's not a great situation for anybody. I wish they had either successfully transitioned or not tried to do it, but they didn't, so we're kind of stuck. And on that, you mentioned, like, the apps not using documents. I don't actually know the answer to this question, but I'm curious to what people, you know, if other people don't know the answer, think to yourself, have you ever even considered this, and what do you think the answer is? Does Final Cut Pro on the iPad autosave everything as you do it, or is there an explicit save function?
I think it autosaves, but I don't know.
It must, because, like, on iPad OS, you can be terminated at any time. Like, you have to, like, the whole, you know, iOS apps basically have to autosave for practical reasons.
I mean, they can. The thing is, like, I'm basically adding, what document model does it present? Yes, technically under the covers they have to be autosaving, but they could be autosaving off to the side and still, like, when you relaunch the app, it shows it as having essentially quote unquote unsaved changes, even though it just reloaded it from disk. But, like, Final Cut Pro is an example because it is file based. Like, you are working on project file, even though the files are bundles or whatever. But, like, it is totally file based. Like, it's not a shoebox app. There's not. I know there's probably some kind of library type structure, but the whole point with Final Cut as you're trading these project files around, you can transfer them, not losslessly, between the Mac version and the iPad version. Like, it is the pro-iest of the pro app that has to deal with, like, media files and libraries of media files and project files and edit decision lists and all these other things, right? And yet, on the iPad, I also assume that it auto-saves everything. So it's an example, if that's true, and I don't even know if it is, like, that's a difficult situation to be in because, like, the rule of, like, well, if you're a shoebox app, then you do this, but if you're not a shoebox app, first of all, that distinction is makes sense to programmers, but not so much to users because, like, how can I tell one way or the other? But second, it's like, okay, so Final Cut Pro, surely that works this way because it's not a shoebox. Like, well, when it's on the iPad, it does, but and here's another question I don't know the answer to. On the Mac, does it autosave? I don't know the answer to that either. But it's like the fact that we could just speculate and be like, I can see how that app could work one way or the other, and both would make sense from a certain perspective. That kind of confusion. That's what they introduced to the Mac platform, that confusion, which is any given app, you're not sure. And it's and this is the bad kind of confusion. I mentioned before when we were talking about Windows, you know, Marco was going on about it, like he wants the app to close when you close the last open window. That distinction I'm in favor of because I feel like most of the time it does what people expect. Close the last window in Calculator, the app quits. Close the last window in Dictionary, the app quits. Close the last window in Microsoft Word, the app doesn't quit. Like, even though that is a quote-unquote inconsistency, I think it's fairly straightforward to know what your app should do and let the developers pick that. But autosave versus not, it's incredibly fraught to the degree where I wonder if, you know, Apple making decisions about its highest end, most pro, most complicated product, even that, the decision is not clear which way they should go. So this is kind of a failed sociological experiment and also a failed technical experiment. And I'm not sure when it'll be resolved, but presumably I'll be dead by then.
Yeah, probably never. I mean, also, by the way, I would also say, like, in the case where you have the same app on iPadOS and Mac, whether they differ in their behavior in this way, I don't think is that important because I don't think there's that many people bouncing between Final Cut on iPad and Final Cut on a Mac because, as you mentioned, like, it's not even a safe transfer. But, like, I think most people probably use one or the other. I could be wrong. I don't have any data on this, but just kind of a gut feeling. Like, I don't hear a lot of people using both actively back and forth. So I think it makes sense, again, like so many things about unifying the platforms, I think it makes sense for the app to do what is the native behavior on the platform it's running on. And that is actually different between iOS and macOS.
Yeah, that makes me wonder what those two apps actually do. I don't necessarily think that they should be consistent with each other, but it's like it's kind of mind-boggling to think that the Mac version, for example, might autosave like the iPad version, and it's done it for years, and we just don't know because we're not Final Cut Pro users. But, like, once you make a decision like this, you know, your users essentially get used to it, and you should just basically stick with it, I guess. But it's so for new users, it's so, like, think of Preview, right? It's not like you don't know that's how Preview works, and yet it keeps catching you because you don't expect it to work that way. And it's not like Preview is a rarely used application that you touch once a year or something. It's still catching you by surprise when you crop it. It's like there's something stubborn about the way things should work. Again, it's like if Calculator didn't quit when you closed the little tiny calculator window. Even if you knew that and you've known it for years, every time you close that calculator window and then an hour later so the calculator was still open, you'd be like, oh, damn, I forgot about that again. Because it's not what you expect. And yeah, it's a problem of their own making. It would have been much more consistent if they just left it alone or they forcibly transitioned everybody, but didn't work out.
To be clear, I have never used Final Cut Pro on the iPad, but on the Mac, as far as I know, every move you make, every step you take, it saves it immediately. There's no, like, file save or anything.
Yeah,
like
I wonder if that was true in Final Cut 7. Maybe that's just a cultural thing with video editors. Like, I'm sure people write it and tell us.
Because that's not how Logic works.
Yeah, well, I mean, they bought that from a different company.
All right, thanks to our sponsors this week, 1Password, Zapier, and Gusto. And thanks to our members who support us directly. You can join us at atp.fm/join. One of the many perks of membership is ATP Overtime, our weekly bonus topic. There is more of the show to be had if you sign up as a member. This week on Overtime, we're going to be talking about how apparently everyone is stealing TV now, which is pretty fun. So we're talking about that in Overtime. Thanks, everybody. You can join us at atp.fm/join to hear that. And we'll talk to you next week.
Hey, what do we want to do about after show? You want to do status board or something else?
Yeah, status board's good.
All right, so a week or so ago, maybe a little more, I don't know, sometime recently, the 2nd of February, I finally got around to putting a post up on my website about my status board, which we've talked about on and off over the years, over the last couple of years on this show. To recap, a few years ago, well, for a long time, I was using Homebridge. There's nothing wrong with Homebridge, but eventually I wanted to have a little more control over what was going on in the house. And so I became one of those people, a home assistant person. And so now that I'm a home assistant person, all I want to do is automate everything in my life. And a few months ago, we were talking on the show, maybe a year ago, about how I really wanted to have like a status board in the house, preferably somewhere downstairs where we spend most of our time, that tells me the state of a few like critical systems in the house.
Did you always call it status board, or does that?
I thought so.
I'm wondering if you're calling it that now because of the recent panic status board thing that I was talking about.
Yeah,
I guess,
maybe.
I mean, it's not really a board, but anyway, no. Continue. I just, my memory is making me think, was it always status board? Is this like a Berenstain Bears thing?
So, but I'm not confident.
It could be. I don't know. Anyway, go on.
And
it's
to
status,
your point.
And it's on a board, kind of.
Well, it's not really on a board, to your point. It's more of
a
series
thin,
of status
it's a very thin
indicators.
Board.
Right? Yeah, yeah. It's status indicators. And so I had initially had the idea, and I remember talking about this on the show. The house was built in the late 90s. So in the kitchen at roughly eye level was a RJ11 jack, you know, a phone line jack. And it was way up high. And the idea was you would mount your kitchen phone way up high, as everyone did at the time, and plug it into that jack right there. And I've since pulled that faceplate off and kind of gotten rid of the jack. And so now it's just a blank faceplate. And my initial cut on this was, hey, I'm going to wire, like, I'm going to drill holes for like two or three LEDs. And I'm going to wire those to like a Raspberry Pi or an ESP32 or something like that. Now, I'm not sure how I was getting power to that ESP32, but we'll leave that aside. But I'll put a couple of LEDs on a blank, you know, wall plate and call it a day. And I told Erin this plan, and she told me in the most loving way possible over her dead fucking body.
Beep.
And so I had to rethink. And we were talking about this on the show, and an incredibly kind listener, Chris R., wrote to me and said, hey, have you heard of these Homeseer switches? And that's H-O-M-E-S-E-E-R. And the company, as far as I can tell, is still around, but these particular switches are discontinued. And so that's a real bummer. But in the midst of all the recommendations for a particular InnoValley switch, which I don't remember specifically which one it is, so I'm not going to link in the show notes, but everyone and their mother recommended these InnoValley switches, which do a very similar thing to what I'm about to describe, but it doesn't work quite as well. And I'll try to come back and explain why. But the way this Homeseer switch works is there's 7 LEDs on the left-hand side of a Decora style switch, like a paddle style switch. And by default, what happens is when it's a dimmer, and so as you hold down on the up button, let's say, each of the LEDs will start increasing over time as the light is getting brighter to indicate how dim or bright the light is. And they will all, you know, be white or whatever. However, you have the option of putting it in what they call status mode. And what that allows you to do is to control each of those 7 LEDs individually. Additionally, each of the LEDs has like 7 or so preset colors that you can use. So Chris R. was kind enough to send me an extra one of these that he had. It works via Z-Wave, which my understanding is, and we talked about this a few weeks ago, Thread is kind of sort of Z-Wave, but over IPv6, whereas Z-Wave is not over IPv6. But nevertheless, it works via RF, and so I needed to get like a little dongle for my Home Assistant installation, like a physical USB-C or USB-A dongle, B, whatever. I can never remember the other ones. I had to get a USB dongle to hook up to the then Synology, now to a NUC, which we'll talk about in another show, in order to be able to talk to Z-Wave. And that was a little challenging, but worked out just fine. And it took a little back and forth for me to figure out how the heck to get this all wired up, figuratively speaking. Literally speaking, it was fairly straightforward. But figuratively speaking, to get it all wired up in Home Assistant and so on and so forth. It's a little bit clunky, but I finally got to the point that I have my quote-unquote status board, which is really more of a status panel or status lights. And I thought it was really fun to document that, which is what I put in the on my website, and we can talk more about it here. But the general gist of it is that there are seven LEDs, like I said, and going from bottom to top, what I have is if there's a red LED lit at the very bottom, the garage door is open. If it is extinguished, if it is not on, then the garage door is closed. There, above that, there is a magenta LED that if it's on, the shed door is open. Gentlemen, how do I know if the shed door is open? A Yolink contact sensor. Additionally, immediately above that, if there's a white LED that's lit, then the Volvo is actively charging. Then I have a blank space because I don't know what else I want to use for that particular spot. And then above that, this is now the fifth one up, the third one down. If there's a blue LED illuminated, then the mail is waiting, which again, I know because of a Yolink contact sensor. Above that, if there is a green LED lit and solid, then there's some amount of laundry that needs attention, which I can dig into more if you want. And then if it's flashing, that means that the laundry is actively running. And then finally, at the very top, there's also a, figuratively speaking, blank spot because I don't know what to put there either. This is incredibly dorky, incredibly overkill, and largely useless. And I got to tell you, gentlemen, it makes me so freaking happy.
I'm surprised you got clearance for a blinking LED when the laundry is running.
Well, because she never pays attention to any of these LEDs.
But it's blinking.
I mean, I could turn that off. That's a choice I made.
Also, but my first question for this is, so you got this thing in here, and I encourage people to go to Casey's blog post to look at this to get an idea of what he's talking about here. Has the rest of your family acclimated to these lights and they know what they mean, or do they ignore them as just visual noise?
More of the latter. I would say of the four of us, I far and away pay the most attention, which tracks. The kids are at least somewhat aware, I think, particularly the red and blue, which is garage door and mail. I don't think they pay that much attention to whether or not the car is charging, which is white.
Why do they care about the garage door?
I don't know, because if they want to, like, run out and, like, get the mail, or if they want to run outside and play basketball or something like that, I think they're at least aware that the red means the garage door is open.
I need to get your kids on the show. I feel like if they're going to run out through the garage, they're going to open the door to the garage from your house and see whether the door is open.
Also
if it's
true.
Not, they'll open it. I'm not sure they're consulting the LED before they
perhaps
make the journey.
Perhaps not, but they are at least aware of red. They are aware of blue. I don't think they care about magenta, white, or green, which would be in order the shed door, the Volvo, and the laundry. I don't think Erin pays any attention to any of this whatsoever. I think she is lightly aware of what each of the colors means, I'm pretty sure.
This would be a great quiz. You should do this. You should
actually.
It casual, like, just like it's not a big pressure thing, and just like see if you can casually figure out. If, you know, quiz your family, what do the light colors mean?
I should do that. And in fact, I should have done that before we recorded. Now I feel really dumb. I didn't think about it, but I should have. But yeah, again, this is very dumb. This is not something that I think most human beings would want in their house, particularly to John's point, a flashing light. Oh, and the red light also flashes when the garage door is actively going up or down. But anyways, I don't think any human would want this except me, but it makes me so incredibly happy.
That's honestly,
like
that's great.
A actual status board, like a panic style status board, would be, I mean, I think you would enjoy messing with that even more because then you'd have like a little animated garage door going up and you'd have all sorts of, you know, graphics and like you could do charts and stuff and all sorts of things. But obviously that would be, you know,
a tremendous eyesore, no matter how good a job I do.
I have to say that I kind of think this is an eyesore, but
I know
it is a smaller eyesore. But it also has so much less information. Like everyone's so used to screens, like, you know, all these smart thermostats that most of us have, they have screens that are much bigger than these tiny LEDs in them, and people just accept them in their homes, and they have all sorts of weird graphics on them, and they change when you walk by because they have proximity sensors and all this stuff. So it's like, is it really that far? And to go to, like, a, you know, an LCD that's the size of this entire panel that you could put some stuff on? I mean, but anyway, if it's working for you and it makes you happy and your family tolerates it, honestly, isn't that the
all
best
accurate.
We can really hope for?
Yes, all of that is very accurate. I don't know. So, I mean, it sounds like, John, you are not at all interested in replicating this. And honestly,
no, absolutely not.
Marco, does this have any appeal to you whatsoever?
No, I have.
Fair enough.
But I recognize the appeal for a lot of people to do stuff like this. It's not worth it enough for me. I have one of those terminals from the problematic guy, which we didn't know at the time either. And it's, you know, it's fun for the family to see like weather and stuff downstairs, but like I will go a whole week forgetting to look at it. Because it's just like it becomes scenery because it isn't reminding me in the corner of my screen every day, remind me this afternoon. What does that mean? I don't care. Like it's not one of those things. It kind of becomes background. And so if I have one of these indicators in my house anywhere, I think the same thing would happen. It would just become background to me. I would stop seeing it, and therefore it would stop serving its function.
Yeah, I totally get that. But it makes me very happy, and there's a little bit more detail on the website or on my website, but it's very cool. Oh, and then coming back to the Innovelli switch, there's a flavor of Innovelli switch that has a bunch of LEDs that you can control, but there is a single diffuser that runs above all of the LEDs. So it's a lot more challenging to figure out what LED is lit and so on and so forth. And so that's one of the reasons why the Innovelli stuff doesn't really appeal to me. Also at the time, I don't remember if they were doing any Z-Wave switches. I don't have Zigbee in the house. And if you don't know what that means, congrats, you're a normal human. But I don't have any Zigbee stuff in the house and I only have this one Z-Wave device, but I didn't want to go and have to get another dongle to have a different communications protocol and blah, blah, blah. And so that's why I didn't go Innovelli, even though people had very good things to say about it. And you can actually buy one, which is an improvement over this HomeSeer thing. So what are you going to do? All right, titles. Let's see. It's very long, but the distribution of white space was unharmonious is good. It is very long.
It's a little long.
Adversarial relationship with myself. I had a similar.
I would put an N in front of that.
An adversarial relationship. I really like that one. I had a
similar
one. I don't remember exactly what I suggested, but it was very close to that.
Same as duplicate. Hopefully, I didn't say that. Did I? Maybe.
Oh, that I said with yourself, and I don't know. And the other one is with myself. I don't recall which one was actually said. I thought it was with yourself because you were talking about, John was talking about Marco, I thought.
No, I think I said I don't have an adversarial relationship with myself in the same way that.
Yeah. Sorry, I think you're right. I think you're right.
Yeah, I think that's it.
I think you're right.
Either way, we're not sticklers for exact quotes. We just go with the best title.
All right, so is that, that what we're going with?
That's pretty good.
Yeah. Let's do it. Put an N in front of it, though.
Okay. Sir, yes, sir. Give me a second to do that. Vamp for me for a moment, and then we can do overtime. So we are, when are we next talking? A week from Wednesday?
Yeah, Wednesday the 25th.
Gracious.
Yeah.
I'm going to miss you guys.
I know. Sorry, my fault this time. All right, thank you, live people, for being live people. And we will talk to you on the 25th. Hopefully we'll have new MacBook Pros by then. And if not, we'll figure it out. We'll just talk more about AI. Everyone loves it. Bye, live people.